The following announcement has been paid for by Journey into Wrestling. Things seem to be changing around here, and I'm talking podcasts, brother.
Journey into Comics Network and no JIW? Where's the wrestling?
That's just it, brah. We're making a comeback. JIW is taking over.
Butt stuff, podcastrophy, the poor rapport, all these new guys on the scene. We're about to show them what podcasting is all about, Chico.
Why don't you tell them when they can hear us, Nate?
Every other Wednesday, right here on the Journey into Wrestling Network.
Anything less is just too civilized. Following is a Journey to Comics Network production.
Put down your hammer and stop breaking those Keurigs. It's time for the Poor Rapport. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 11 of The Poor Rapport. I am your host, Andrew Poor, and I want to thank you for listening. Now, it has been a crazy week we've had here. There's been boycotts, there's been violence, there's been countless more sexual assault allegations that we have seen from all across the spectrum, from Hollywood to politics and everything in between. Now, what I want to start with is the current boycott, which is the hashtag boycott Keurig, and all the videos of people taking and just smashing their Keurigs with hammers, throwing them off their balcony, just doing basically the scene from Office Space with their Keurig. Now, what this broke out from was that Roy Moore, who is a candidate running for U.S. Senator, it was recently reported that he had supposed sexual relations with a 14-year-old girl and a 17-year-old girl, I believe. And Sean Hannity, on his show, which I don't remember the name of his show, to be honest, I don't watch it, basically said, like, it was defending Roy Moore and disproving the allegations and all that. And a bunch of supporters on Twitter went out and tweeted Keurig about their advertising for a show that was approving of relations with a 14-year-old or a 17-year-old for someone who was vastly older. And Keurig decided, after consulting with their PR team, because obviously you don't want to be associated with those kind of events, to pull their advertising from the show. And then this led to the outcry of a lot of Sean Hannity supporters, which happens to usually co-align with a lot of Trump supporters, saying, we're no longer going to support Keurig. And then there was the Twitter was trending, the hashtag boycott Keurig. And then that's when all the videos came out of people just destroying their Keurigs. And their hope that, like, oh, this will get the point across. And kind of how I feel on it is, and I've put this on my, I guess, my personal Facebook, but that when you're boycotting an item, if this comes to, like, maybe a sports jersey, if the most recent I remember is when LeBron James left Cleveland for Miami, and a ton of his fans from Cleveland were burning their jerseys. The point of that is, oh yeah, you're upset, but you're not affecting any business by doing this. You paid for the jersey, you paid for the item. You're destroying it is something you can do because you paid for it. They still have your money regardless. So the whole thing with this boycott Keurig, yes, that maybe means you're not going to be a return customer, but with this business, they have your $100 or more that you paid for that Keurig coffee maker. And if you throw it, break and everything, they still had that money you paid initially. Sure, though, you're probably going to notice a trickle-down effect that maybe a year from now, when people typically upgrade their Keurig device or replace it if it gets old, maybe they won't see that return business. But with this day and age, when there's so much information coming in, these boycotts and these protests and everything, they fluctuate. There's an ebb and flow to it. So it might seem like the most necessary thing right now, but 6 months from now, this might be completely over and people are going to go out and buy their Keurig again because it's a good deal or they need a coffee maker. So that's kind of my thoughts on it, is that there's no sense to... Like, I remember hearing about people who are going out and buying Harry Potter books and movies and then immediately burning them, which seems counterproductive because you're giving the people you dislike your money to then go and destroy it, which just means you don't have that item. They still count it as someone bought an item, which only helps their bottom line. That's like saying, like, if I sell someone a glass vase for $10 and they immediately take that vase and then throw it against the wall and shatter it and go, ha, and I go, well, okay, that's fine. I still have your $10, so I still got what I wanted out of it. You just don't have what you paid for. So that's kind of my thoughts on it. I'm sure there'll be an issue, but I remember even when there was the whole Chick-fil-A incident with... they came out with their stance, I believe it was against like the LGBTQ community, and there was a big boycott Chick-fil-A, and I haven't heard anything about that since then, so it was definitely a very short incident, and I don't even hear about it anymore. I didn't really think on that this morning when I was kind of prepping the show about what these kind of things that people are talking about, and it's just another one of those crazy things, and this is a recent thing, as I think... over the weekend, like late weekend, that this whole incident came about. And there's so many people defending the actions of Romer, kind of circling back to the origins of this story, but will immediately condemn a celebrity for a similar action, which is almost like a double standard. Like, if it's someone I already support, it's more easy to believe that it's wrong or it's something that I can ignore. But if it's someone I already dislike, like, it's a lot of almost, it's becoming a political issue in an extent, like, oh, this person's a Republican, maybe it's not as bad as it thinks it is, versus, oh, this is the Hollywood elite, these are these high-level liberals that are finally getting their just desserts from that position, and they deserve what's coming to them. And it's just, we're also in a world where allegations equal truth. And I'm sure it's kind of how it is at this point, that these events, a lot of these incidents that have been coming out, I'm sure the majority of them are true, but there's probably some that are false that are going to take away from the cause of some of these that are true and should be dealt with. And I honestly believe that if all these allegations are true, they deserve everything that's coming to them. And one of the recent ones that hit kind of close to home, beyond the whole Kevin Spacey thing, which I'll go into that now. So since I think my last two episodes is where I kind of talked about the whole Kevin Spacey thing. In the past couple weeks, Kevin Spacey's career has plummeted to below rock bottom. He's lost out on movies, planned awards. He got officially fired from his show. Like, they're no longer going to produce House of Cards involving Kevin Spacey. The last reports I've read is that they've scrapped the script. I don't know how many weeks in production they were, but they're just going to not use that and are going to try and find a different direction to go with season 6, dealing with his character's absence, if it meant recasting just to finish off his story, if it meant killing him off screen, saying that between the hiatus, for those of you who guys watched up through season 5, his post-presidential life, dealing with President Claire Underwood, maybe... getting murdered in there, maybe something that Claire orchestrated, or if it's going to be just ignoring the fact that he existed and just continuing Claire's arc to end the series. And all the reports I've read is said that the writer's room and the showrunners are currently trying to figure out a way to close the arc without Kevin Spacey's character, which is kind of hard since he was the central figure of the show. Now, the show is based on a British show of the same name, and I believe the last season of that and the last book, he had been assassinated or killed in some manner, and they continued with her playing like the Lady Macbeth type role, finishing off the run. So they're probably trying to adapt more from that, and hopefully we still get a good product. I'm still a big fan of the show. It really does suck that this had to happen, but based on all the allegations came out, Kevin Spacey deserves to have his career completely affected by all this. And we're going to kind of see how further his legacy is standing. We've seen they've already pulled him from that Ridley Scott movie where he played J. Paul Getty and are going to replace him with Christopher Plummer. And that movie's still going to release next month, which is kind of crazy. A movie that was done, trailered, going to be released, or just they're just going to remove Kevin Spacey's character and all that filming he did completely from the movie and redo it right now as we're talking and then get it back up. I guess he only recorded for 2 weeks, so it's not a lot of scenes he has to worry about, but it's still kind of a monumental event that a movie that essentially can be finished can be just cut out and replaced to still save the work that everyone else did and prevent it from being tainted by what happened. Now, another thing that really hit close to home was over the weekend, it was announced that there were sexual assault allegations against Andrew Kreisberger on the CW Arrow shows, I believe all four of them. And kind of first I'm like, oh, that just sucks. I remember sharing it to the network page and everyone else was kind of upset that people actually watched those shows. And it kind of led to that on yesterday morning at the time of you're listening to this, a lot of the Arrowverse female stars came out with statements of support of women's rights and understanding that, which kind of leads me to believe that there's a lot of truth to these allegations, and we're going to kind of see how these Arrowverse shows move forward without one of their main executive producers who helped create a lot of these shows years ago. So we're not kind of keep up with the story as it develops, and we'll see if he's officially suspended, if he never comes back to the show, if there's anything that he was involved with that has to lead to that. But I don't see these shows going where a lot of these shows are very much about women's empowerment and women's rights, and these shows will stand without him and they will stand against him. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see their own narrative story kind of involving this type of situation in one of the condos. I wouldn't be surprised if Supergirl did an episode involving a high-level person and some less than desirable attention to Kara or someone else within her world. So we'll kind of see how this story plays out, but I'll definitely be keeping up with this because those shows are very important to me and I wouldn't want any of them affected by this stuff. And I guess kind of moving forward, over the past weekend, I got to have kind of some fun. I had flown back during the week, so I was able to kind of enjoy the weekend for once. I'm not traveling to Colorado. I still go back. Actually, I'll be back in Colorado by the time you listen to this recording, so that's kind of how it is here. But one thing I got to do, which I always enjoy doing, is I got to visit used bookstore, do some Christmas shopping and some shopping for myself, and I was able to go to my local Family Video and rent a few movies. And I really encourage my listeners to really go out and support your local used bookstore or a local chain of used bookstores. Like I don't have too many used bookstores around me, but I go to Half Price Books, which is kind of in the Midwest and kind of around everywhere, which is essentially, it's just a chain of used bookstores. And they always give me money, and they had a coupon weekend. So I went and got a couple books, like the Bryan Cranston biography, as well as the Blu-ray trilogy of The Dark Knight. So we got the Batman Begins, Dark Knight, Dark Knight Rises. So I'm pretty happy with that investment because I've been slowly trying to upgrade my movie collection from some of the ones I really like from DVDs to Blu-rays. But I have hundreds and hundreds of movies, so it's a very slow process. And you can't really just drop that kind of money because I need to put two copies. So as I increase one to Blu-ray, I try and sell off my DVDs to recoup some of that cost difference. End up with a better quality film to kind of go forward, and I'm sure by the time I get my whole collection of Blu-ray, there'll be whatever's next that I'll have to deal with. But it's a slow process, but I'm happy, and I was able to rent a few movies, including a movie I got to see on the plane on my trip back that I kind of want to discuss now. So on my flight back, it was a late flight, and typically they don't let you, you have to basically pay for the movie you watch, but because we had the de-icing issue and all that stuff, they were able to watch it for free. So I was able to watch War of the Planet of the Apes, which was a great movie, and it kind of closed out the trilogy that was Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And I thought one thing I really liked about the movie is that it was not just another sequel. It really tied up the story really nice, and it had a nice narrative progression. It seems like each of these movies really pulls from where it came before, and it's this whole arc that involved Caesar and his evolution from I forget what a baby ape is called. It's not really a cub, but when he was a young ape with the James Franco character kind of being raised and really strengthening his knowledge, to him having the instant going to the camp, all of them getting infected, and saw the human population get infected and dying, and you saw them all becoming smarter and escaping, and the riot that kind of led to this, to the second movie, which was they'd found a space to live, and there were people trying to survive and hunt, and there was a little bit, and then it really culminated into this war, which kind of led to, like, basically it's two armies, and it's turned to be like an outside faction of the military that was really against these apes. And it was actually kind of cool. I like when they do something cinematically, and they're able to kind of, it was almost like a Star Wars introduction that kind of led into War of the Planet of the Apes. It was like a short description of what happened in each movie, with like Rise was like shown in red, and then as all the text went out, it was just Rise, and then it did the short description of the Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and then Dawn was all that was left, and then it popped up what led into this section of the movie, and it was war was what was left, and you kind of jump right in, and you're able to see characters from the earlier films. I'm going to kind of walk through the synopsis of, or I guess the plot that I'm going to read for you guys, just to kind of get you guys up to speed. So if you haven't seen War of the Planet of the Apes, I encourage you to kind of stop listening here, or kind of jump to the end, because I'll talk about something else at the very end of the episode. But I'm going to talk about three movies over this, but I'm going to start with The War of the Planet of the Apes, which was the one I saw on my plane. So I'm just going to jump right in with the plot, which is 2 years after the U.S. military was called to fight off an increasingly intelligent and dangerous tribe of apes, starting a devastating war between the two species, the apes clan, led by the chimpanzee Caesar, are attacked in the woods by a rogue paramilitary faction known as Alpha Omega, led by a mysterious colonel. Alpha Omega has in its service apes called donkeys, which is basically, they have donkeys around their backs. They're ones that are against Caesar's group and are just doing that just to survive. Those were the ones that were previously followed Koba, who was the ape from the first and second movie that was against ape. I'm kind of throwing my own description of all these things. So Koba was the maniacal, human-hating bonobo who led a failed coup against Caesar. That was during Dawn. He was the one who remember shot him and then left and tried to get the apes against humanity because of how they mistreated him in the first movie. So he started a war after leading a vengeful attack against human survivors in San Francisco. During Alpha Omega's attack, the human soldiers are met by heavy ape resistance. Four soldiers and a donkey gorilla named Red are captured by the apes. Caesar arrives and releases the human soldiers, telling them to deliver a message to the colonel that he killed Koba for starting the war, and that he desired peace between the humans and apes. Caesar then orders that Red is to be imprisoned, but Red escapes, injuring the albino gorilla Winter. Soon after, Caesar's son Blue Eyes and his lieutenant Rocket return from a journey to find a safe haven for the apes. They report they have found a place across the desert that is perfect for the clan. Winter, still frightened from the soldiers' attacks, wants to leave immediately, but Caesar does not think they are prepared to leave so soon. That night, a group of Alpha Omega soldiers, led by the colonel, infiltrates the apes' home behind a waterfall. The apes discover their presence and kill them all except the colonel, whom Caesar encounters preparing to escape. Discovering that the colonel has killed his wife, Cornelia, along with Blue Eyes, and enraged Caesar lunges at the colonel but fails to prevent him from escaping out of the waterfall. Upon discovering that Winter has disappeared, Luca, a gorilla, and Caesar's secondary lieutenant, believes that he has betrayed them out of cowardice. Leaving his younger son Cornelius in the care of Blue Eyes' wife, Lake, Caesar departs to exact revenge on the colonel for their deaths of his wife and oldest son. He is accompanied by Maurice, an orangutan, and Caesar's advisor, Luca, and Rocket. The other apes head for the desert. During the journey, the apes encounter an abandoned village encounter a soldier and kill him. Caesar, Maurice, Luke, and Rocket search the dead soldier's home. Maurice discovers a girl who the soldier was looking after. She's apparently unable to speak. Maurice befriends and adopts the girl, giving her a small ragdoll. And Maurice, for you guys to remember, was the orangutan who doesn't actually speak but is very good at sign language. He was the one that was at the facility in the first movie and is kind of Caesar's more of his right-hand man. Caesar's party eventually sneak inside an Alpha Omega camp on a beach and encounter Winter, who has volunteered to become a donkey for the soldiers in return for sparing his life. He tells Caesar's group that the colonel has departed for a location called the Border, where soldiers further north will meet them. Winter tries to call out to the Alpha Omega soldiers to save him, and Caesar and the others restrain him from making noise. In this struggle, Caesar accidentally smothers and kills Winter. Caesar begins to worry that he is becoming like Koba by killing his fellow apes and seeking revenge. While following the soldiers to the Border, the group discovers some soldiers who have been shot and left for dead. Their examination of a soldier who survived reveals that he, like the girl, cannot speak. At the soldiers' urging, Caesar kills him. Later, they encounter a bat ape, a reclusive chimpanzee hermit who lived in the Sierra Zoo before the simian flu pandemic. Bat ape reveals that the human soldiers are encamped at the Border and has until he agrees to leave them there. When the groups arrive at the Border, they see hundreds of apes held captive inside a former quarantine facility. While getting a closer look, Luca is killed protecting Caesar from an Alpha Omega patrol, angering Caesar and causing him to proceed alone. Caesar discovers that the captured apes belong to his clan and are being forced to build a wall with no food or water. After Caesar is captured by Red, the colonel reveals that to Caesar that the simian flu virus has mutated and now causes humans who survived the original strain to become mute, which he believes is a sign of devolution to the primitive state. Caesar deduces that the colonel is barricading the facility to fend off remnants of the U.S. Army from the north who are coming to execute him because he favors massacring any infected humans, including his own son, to stop the spread of the virus. Caesar is recommended by the colonel for his intelligence, and the colonel explains that he is fighting a holy war for humanity's survival. While Caesar is tortured with starvation, the mute girl, whom Maurice names Nova, because they find a Chevy Nova car plate, little tag that goes on like the back or the bumper of the car. And it's kind of funny for me because one of my cars I had was a Chevy Nova, so I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. So they sneak into the facility to give Caesar food and water and a ragdoll. To prevent Nova from being discovered, Rocket allows himself to be captured as a diversion. The next day, the colonel comes to see if Caesar is still alive and confiscates Nova's doll upon discovering it. Together, Caesar and Rocket are able to work out a means of escape via an underground tunnel that leads out of the facility. Maurice and Bad Ape use the tunnel to rescue the apes, and Caesar orders the others to escape while he goes to confront the colonel as the facility comes under attack by the Northern Army. Caesar reaches the colonel and prepares to kill him, but discovers that Nova's doll has infected him with that mutated virus, rendering him unable to speak. Caesar spares the colonel and watches as he uses his pistol to commit suicide rather than regressing to a primitive state. During the battle between Alpha Omega and the Northern Army, the escaping apes come under fire from Alpha Omega. Red watches the apes struggle to escape and being picked off by the humans, and seems to be disturbed by watching his own kind suffer such a fate. Caesar attempts to attack the Alpha Omega forces behind, but is shot with a crossbow by Preacher, one of the Alpha Omega soldiers he has previously set free. In an act of redemption, Red saves Caesar's life by killing Preacher with a grenade launcher, and gets shot by an Alpha Omega superior as a result. In the chaos, Caesar blows up a large fuel tank, causing a cascade of explosions, which destroys the Alpha Omega facility, allowing the Northern Army to win the battle. However, the army is subsequently devastated by an avalanche, which sees the other apes carrying Nova survive by climbing nearby trees. The remaining apes depart the facility and cross the desert to find an oasis. While the other apes joyously celebrate their new home, Maurice discovers Caesar's wounds. Maurice then speaks, telling the dying Caesar that Cornelius will know who his father was, what he stood for, and what he did to protect the apes. Caesar then slowly and silently succumbs to his wounds, dying peacefully while Maurice mourns his passing as the other apes look on. Alright, so that's the rough and long of the kind of the plot of that movie. So basically, if you hadn't seen the movie and read that and listened to what I said reading that description, that's entirely the plot. That's basically from start to finish what the movie's about. And I thought it was really interesting how it really closed out Caesar's story, and there was a whole subplot of that virus which has affected humanity from the beginning, killing a lot of them, to be to mutate and to not just cause death, but to cause the mute behavior and kind of the regression, which allowed them to behave a lot more like apes. So it's kind of like they were kind of shifting on the food chain or in the level of evolution, the apes becoming knowledgeably superior and able to speak, and then the humans losing the ability to speak and becoming inferior as a result. And the only thing that really sucked about when I watched this movie is that, since I watched it on a plane, I had to basically got to the point where they were on the trees after the avalanche, and then we had landed, and then they cut off the screen, so I didn't really know the last few minutes of the film. I think there was like 5 or 6 minutes left, which was essentially them going to the oasis and Caesar dying. So I was able to infer that was where the story was going. I got through all the major plot of the movie by that point. But I still really enjoyed the movie. I've actually liked this whole series. I remember the Mark Wahlberg movie from like 10 years ago or more, which wasn't that great a movie. It was kind of the last movie that still had that kind of effect of the masks. And back to the throwback to those really old Planet of the Apes movies. But these are the first ones that like invoke that motion capture and the CGI and really kind of made Andy Serkis's career post Lord of the Rings and kind of led to his career now. But I really enjoyed this movie. It really made my flight go by faster. And yeah, it great cast. Woody Harrelson in this movie was just horrific and haunting. And he's had a nice resurgence in the past few years with the movies he's done, so I'm glad to see him doing another have another great role and something to different kind of character to play. And yeah, I'm really curious to see. I know this story kind of closes up. I don't know if there's plans to do any other story within that world post Caesar story, if it's just going to be the end. But yeah, I definitely liked the movie. I encourage everyone to see it and kind of I'm actually planning, I think once I probably pick up the War of the Planet of the Apes movie when it comes out to rent, which I believe it's already out now. Once I eventually buy it, I think I'm going to plan to watch all three of those movies together. Kind of get a good story for that. So, definitely a great movie. I encourage everyone to watch it. And I guess with that, I'll put over to the two movies I watched this past weekend that I really wanted to see. Now, because it was really long tease, I don't think I'm going to read through the plot of this other movie, which I watched, I believe, like Friday night. The next one I watched after my plane, which was Baby Driver. Now, Baby Driver was that Edgar Wright movie that was made that had that, like, pretty star-studded cast. It was, like, a heist movie. And it was actually the first Kevin Spacey movie I've seen since The Allegations. And it was kind of weird to watch. Because I very much liked Kevin Spacey's performance in this movie. But it's still weird because when you see him, it gets that you get that little nudging in the back of your mind about what he's done in his personal life, and it kind of affects how you watch the movie. And I'm sure when I watch some of his classic movies, I'm probably going to feel that same way, just because there's going to permanently be a negative association in my mind with Kevin Spacey. But I really liked how this movie was done. Edgar Wright has proven that he can do a lot with music and with interesting plots and can really put an all-star cast to good use. I guess the short and dry of the plot is the plot follows Baby, who is played by Ansel Elgort, who's done a couple movies. He's a young getaway driver and a music lover who must work for a kingpin, played by Kevin Spacey. And one of the big things about this movie is it features kind of choreography which aligns a lot of the actors' movements and kind of synchronizes with the soundtrack. There's a lot of good music in there, and there's a lot of it's one of those things where another one of those movies where like gunshots and driving and actions that the driver does are kind of aligned perfectly with the movie. It kind of reminds you of if you saw the trailer for The Punisher, how the gunshots and a lot of the actions were tied up with that music. Like, the whole film was like that. The music choice was great. The chase scenes with them in the cars and all the characters were great. I didn't... the only thing I didn't quite get into was the kind of the love story between Ansel Elgort's character and the waitress at the diner, which I'm kind of forgetting her name. kind of surprised. I didn't realize that John Bernthal was in the movie, who's going to be starring in Punisher. So I thought it was kind of funny that he did this. It also has John Hamm and Jamie Foxx and Lily James. And so definitely a very star-studded movie. And I think it's one of the, I think, the best Edgar Wright movies I've seen. Definitely liked it more than Scott Pilgrim, but I don't know if it has the same rewatchability as, like, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So it's kind of one of those things, but it really makes me sad that we never got to see the full version of the Edgar Wright's Ant-Man that he was developing for Marvel. Because if it was anything like this movie, I think we would have been in for a real treat. But not to say that the Ant-Man that we got was bad by any means, but I think we could have got a much more interesting movie if this is the kind of stuff that Edgar Wright was bringing in basically his next movie after Ant-Man. But yeah, definitely a great film. Love the character. I love the lip syncing that Ansel Elgort's character did with a lot of the music he was playing, because he had the tinnitus, so he always had headphones in. And then the whole weird plot of him recording his conversations with the team, they're doing the heists, and like mixing it to make like music with the word. It was weird, but it was kind of interesting at the same time. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I encourage all my listeners to watch that movie. Definitely gave it, I guess if we're going with my foodies, definitely like 4.5 out of 5 pizza slices. There wasn't really much to not like about this movie. And the last movie I watched, which I'm kind of surprised it didn't get much award show love when it first came out, which was Silence, which is the Martin Scorsese film that he's been developing since like the late 80s, when he's finally got around to make. So it's basically I'm trying to see if I can find the plot. I'm going to read the short plot again because there's a lot of names I can't pronounce, but basically the story is, it follows two 17th century Jesuit priests who travel from Portugal to Edo-era Japan to locate their missing mentor and spread the Catholic Christianity. The story is set in time that when it was common for Christians to hide from persecution following the suppression of Japanese Roman Catholics during the Shimabara Rebellion against the Tokugawa Shogunate. So what I've read about this since seeing the movie is that this was a major passion project for Martin Scorsese since he read the book, and he's been wanting to develop this movie for years, and at one point it had like Daniel Day-Lewis attached to it and some other big names, but he wanted to make sure he got the right ages. And I think the only thing really weird about it is that you have Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver playing Portuguese priests with very Portuguese names. It just doesn't fit with these two white guys. But outside of that, it was kind of a phenomenal film. It was a very long film. It clocked in at like 2 hours and 45 minutes or thereabout, which makes it a very long movie. I thought it was just over 2 hours, so I was kind of waiting to see how this movie was going to end, because at the usual ending of a movie time, there was still a lot that was left unanswered. So really kept watching it. The big main characters that anyone would know were Liam Neeson, who played the mentor priest, who you get to see a little bit of at the beginning and then at the end of the movie. And then you have Adam Driver and Andrew Garfield as the two priests as they travel from Portugal to Japan and are they're kind of teaching and doing what they do. They're being priests to these little subgroups of Christians that they had, converted, when Catholic priests started coming to Japan to kind of spread the gospel and, get followers. So it was definitely a very interesting movie. I read a lot about how, Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver both lost a ton of weight to play these kind of emaciated priests over their duration of their journey there, and when they're being withheld food and had scarce availability to food and water. They also did. They also worked with a Jesuit priest to kind of get to kind of learn more about the background of their characters. They did that whole. They did a whole 7-day silent kind of prayer retreat, which is basically you just don't talk for 7 days, and it's a lot of inward reflection and prayer, and it really apparently helped them kind of get into the role. It was filmed in Taiwan, from what I understand, which kind of stood in for that era of Japan with a lot of the tree and decor and style, and it really made for a, kind of a fantastic film. It really drew me in. There's a lot of Japanese, and there's a lot of names that are hard to pronounce, but if you can get past that, it really, really draws you in, and I really respect Martin Scorsese films. A lot of his films are classics, and this really proves how interested he is in religion and faith, and I really don't have much else to say about it. It was just, I encourage everyone to watch it because my description or me talking about the film doesn't really do it justice, but you gotta sit in for the long haul, and kind of the big plot of that movie is that they have to basically renounce their faith, and it basically, the movie ends after the one of the priests gets tortured and drowned in front of the other priest who they didn't know each other were going to be there. They're just their separate tortures, and basically you can see the characters kind of they kind of age them a little bit in the show to show how long they've been there, and it really ended up being that all of the priest's followers, all of Andrew Garfield's priest's followers, even though they had renounced their faith, were going to be tortured and starved and punished until Andrew Garfield's priest renounced his faith, because that's the one they wanted. That's their praise, and that's their what these inquisitors who were the ones going after these priests and the people with Catholic faith or Christian beliefs in Japan. So seeing as knocking a priest off his pedestal and getting him to renounce the faith was seen as some kind of prize. And they were actually so desperate to get these people kind of flushed out of Japan that they were giving like 300 silver pieces for a priest and 200 for a high-level religious leader and 100 for any believer of Christianity or of the Catholic faith. So they really kind of went and it's a kind of a rough movie to watch because there's a lot of torture and emaciation. It's kind of like watching Schindler's List. It's just one of those movies that it's hard to watch more than once in some of those parts. Actually, Schindler's List is also a Liam Neeson movie. So, yeah. Liam Neeson can really bring it in a heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching movie. So, and it kind of, the movie ends, he kind of hears the voice of God giving him basically permission to step on this image of Christ and kind of renounce his faith. And he has to do this basically like weekly or daily or something. It's just a further affirmation in his apostolate or in his renouncement of the faith. So it ends up being kind of has a weird job with the Japanese. All the imports they get in, these priests have to inspect like the art and the books and the items to make sure there's not hidden Christian items or artifacts in there, like crosses or pictures or... So basically, it comes to a point where they're sitting there inspecting items and going Christian, non-Christian, and if it's Christian, the people who brought it in get punished by the Japanese. And even after Guerrero, who was the Liam Neeson priest, who adopted a Japanese name, the same as Andrew Garfield's character did later on, even after he dies, Andrew Garfield's priest continues to do that job and ends up with a being essentially forced to marry a Japanese woman and kind of lives out the rest of his life. And then when he dies, they have a typical Buddhist funeral and he's put in like this round coffin kind of in a seated position, and it kind of cuts in as the movie ends to a very aged, long white hair, white beard, very wrinkled dead Andrew Garfield, and inside his hand you see a crudely shaped crucifix to prove that even through all the stuff he did it in knowing that he was still preserving his faith and still doing what he thought he needed to do as a priest, and kind of spreading that faith throughout Japan. And that was just during the major kind of persecution of Christians in other countries, and that's still something that goes on in some of the Middle Eastern countries or in more recent memory. So yeah, definitely another great movie and a very powerful movie, and I don't encourage you to watch it later at night when you're just kind of... It gets you very introspective and you'll... Yeah, but those were the three movies I had watched this week, and I still have plans to watch. I got those two of those movies from Family Video, and it, since I bought those new rented those new releases, there were I got $2 movies, so I still need to watch Gold, which is that Matthew McConaughey treasure hunting film, and The Nice Guys, which is that Ryan Gosling and I forget the other actor's name, not Kurt Russell. I forget his name. I apologize, but yeah. So I'm really looking forward to watching the those other two movies. Just didn't plan to, but it's nice to kind of revisit these. And I'm really surprised that Silence didn't get any love. I know it was a very crowded award season last year, but yeah, I thought it was very well made, very well produced. The acting was impeccable. Definitely 5 out of 5 stars. But it's not necessarily everyone's cup of tea, and that's probably why it didn't get as much love as it did at the Golden Globes or the Academy Awards or any of those Film Institute Awards. I don't have too much left. I guess the last thing I kind of want to talk about is I went on a haunted history tour of Chicago on Saturday night, which was really cool. It was kind of a bus tour, and we went to all these really interesting places. Went to like the old Fort Dearborn, which is kind of in the middle of downtown, right? Pretty close to where Trump Tower is. Went to the spot where Wayne Gacy parked his car, where he picked up men to then, like, rape and murder, and where there was the site of this, the most devastating theater fire in the world. Took us to all these, like, major places where events happened and where people were just, went through just major hardship, and, like, the sinking of the USS Eastland in the Chicago River, and got to take pictures, and there was not a lot of ghostly things or paranormal incidents. He wanted to take pictures of the water to see, because some cases were reported closer to the time of the year, is that you can see faces in the water. I'm not as into the paranormal as my fiance is, but I'm really into the history of this stuff, so kind of getting a history tour with some of the haunting stuff in there, it was very interesting. I think the creepiest spot we went to wasn't really a major place. It was we went kind of behind an Office Max where this kind of this cement landing was that overlooked the river, and this is where the Ripper crew disposed of one of their bodies. Like, they chopped it up into thousands of pieces and just threw it in the river, and that was kind of creepy because it was late at night and we were there, but it's also right next to a homeless tent community, so it was kind of like there's just a dozen or so tents to your right about 20 feet away, and you're like, this is a little uncomfortable for a Saturday night in Chicago, but it's another one of those things that kind of happens. Also to learn more about H.H. Holmes and kind of more stuff he did with his victims and kind of spots that he preserved, like the Congress Theater and, or not Congress Theater, the Congress Hotel. So yeah, it was definitely a very eventful trip, and it was through Weird Chicago, which is, they wrote a book, and it's a part of that Weird Illinois series of books. For those who like that kind of stuff of things that happened in Illinois or in Chicago, I encourage you to pick it up. I have it on my, kind of on my Christmas list if one of my relatives wants to get it for me. Otherwise, I'll probably just buy it for myself next year. But yeah, it was a kind of an interesting way to top off a weekend, and my fiance loved it, which always makes things better. And I got to kind of walk around a little bit in downtown Chicago and went to the biggest McDonald's I've ever been to in my life, which is downtown. It's a 2-story McDonald's that's a classic rock and roll style, which if you've seen the one in Danville, which is where I'm from, it's like that one, but like 5 times the size with 2 levels. It was interesting, but I guess when you're downtown Chicago and you're at McDonald's, you need that kind of size and that much. Because you probably have a lot of through traffic through the drive-thru and into the store at any given time during the day. So it's something that's definitely very necessary. And yeah, I guess you can, I think, rent the upstairs for like gatherings, because there's an escalator, and I think you can close it off and just have a private event up there if you wanted to, which I'm not sure why you would, but to each their own. And I guess that's really it. I know there's a lot more to talk about in terms of these Trump news and the sexual assault allegations, but I think that's enough for today. with anything new, I'll talk about it in episode 12. But I want to thank everyone for listening. Thank you and have a great day. And I will see you next week. Thanks, guys.